27 minutes past seven on Tuesday night's arena. Stephen Benedict was in with us recently talking about the work of Federico Fellini. So we've asked him to take a look at some other cinema greats tonight. He's here to talk about the French director who's the father of the Nouvelle Vague or New Wave School of Filmmaking, François Truffaut. The school has also boasted such groundbreaking directors as Jean-Luc Godard, Claude Chabrol, Eric Rohmer, Jacques Rivette, Louis Malle, Agnès Varda and others. Stephen, Truffaut and some of those other filmmakers referred to definitely as auteurs, I suppose, the auteur, the visionary in the filmmaking process, takes the really carries the can, brings the whole idea from conception right through to creation. But Truffaut really linked this into the role of director, and much of this is an essay he wrote when he was just 21, extraordinary essay, A Certain Tendency in French Cinema. What type of ideas, groundbreaking ideas, was he talking about there?
Well, the reason why he wrote the essay in the first place, Sean, was because he was looking at the French cinema in the 40s and 50s, and he was, even though he was only 21 and even younger, he was deeply disillusioned by it. He found that the films that were being made resembled a production line, as though they were cars coming out of a factory of Henry Ford. You can have the car in any colour you want, so long as it's black. The films were well made, but they were completely impersonal. And what Truffaut was asking for was for sincerity in filmmaking. And so what he looked for in the films was a unique style and a unique theme that you could actually apply or read from a film. And you could then sort of recognise that these filmmakers were the auteurs, as you said, the authors of the film, the instigators of the film. Prior to Truffaut writing the essay in 1954, practically all of film criticism focused exclusively on what was happening on screen and the story and the star, and that was it. Directors were very, very rarely mentioned, if at all. Even writers were very mentioned, even more seldom. And so what Truffaut did was he shifted the focus of attention 180 degrees from what was on the screen to who was behind the camera. And who was behind the camera was the creator of the film. Now, it wasn't the actor, and it wasn't the producer, and it wasn't even the directors who were saying it's the auteur, the highest, the most talented of filmmakers around. And he identified an exclusive group of these filmmakers in American cinema that would have been typified by the likes of Orson Welles, Alfred Hitchcock and John Ford. And these personalities were so articulate in the art of film that they determined not just the film's very being, but also its meaning. Their vision was so unique and their style was so unique that they were immediately identifiable. And so in today's terms, we now can speak of a film as a Steven Spielberg movie, a Martin Scorsese picture, a Wes Anderson movie. It's not only the themes that they investigate. Spielberg, you know, people always talk about Spielberg's films investigating the family or the breakup of a family unit, and Scorsese investigating criminality. And then, you know, people say Wes Anderson's films are very whimsical. But it's not only the themes, it's the way they present those themes in terms of the camera composition, the camera movement, the editing, and the use of sound. So, you know, Truffaut, by focusing on the people who were behind the camera, not necessarily was on the screen, shifted the attention of film criticism.
Yeah, and indeed, we'll hear a little bit of Wes Anderson, Scorsese, and Spielberg speaking about Truffaut and the influence he had on them. But I want to start by listening to Truffaut. I'm interested that you did mention that, okay, a 21-year-old giving out about what's gone before him is not that unusual, really, is it? And he should have been doing that. But that he could find models in American cinema, because I want to take a clip of Truffaut himself talking about the difference between American cinema and French cinema.
Right.
And he gives us an idea about how he works himself here. Now, it's in translation, so you hear him first in French and then the translation comes in English.
Je travaille pas beaucoup avant les films.
I don't work very much before the filming.
Toute l'équipe travaille.
The entire crew works.
Ils disent il faut pas déranger Truffaut.
And they say we shouldn't bother Truffaut.
Et en général, je suis dans mon bureau en train de lire Le Monde.
And in general, I'm in my office reading Le Monde.
Alors, je vais dans les endroits avec le décorateur, avec mon assistante Suzanne Schiffman et avec Nestor Almendros.
I go to the location with my set decorator, my assistant Suzanne Schiffman, my head of photography Nestor Almendros.
Là, je vous parle de la façon de française de faire les films. On va chez les gens, on va dans des maisons, quoi. On va dans des endroits qui ne sont pas des studios.
Here I'm speaking of a French method of making films. In other words, you actually go to people's houses and not to the studios.
Peut-être qu'on fait ça un peu à New York, mais pas à Los Angeles.
Maybe you do that a little in New York, but not in Los Angeles.
And there's François Truffaut in a masterclass about filmmaking, but also a masterclass in how to play an audience and a great Gallic sense of humour in there, obviously, in the early part. And he's very funny about I do nothing. But then he gets to that bit towards the end there, Stephen Benedict, where he talks about I go to the location and he lists off those people behind the camera that he brings to the location with him. It really does give us an insight into how he worked.
Yeah, and it's crucial there that he mentioned his cinematographer, his regular cinematographer, Nesta Almendros, but also he named his longtime and close associate, Susanna Schiffman. And Schiffman was a very, very important figure in Truffaut's career as a director because, you know, the thing that we've got to understand what Truffaut achieved with the auteur theory and personalizing filmmaking is that he broke open an enormous avenue for the exploration for female directors to map out women's lives on screen that had hitherto been too ignored. Okay, and we've got to remember that the industrialized form of filmmaking, which back then wouldn't have been considered an art the way Truffaut wanted it to be, women's positions in film was very, very limited, and women's voices and women's visions simply did not exist. They weren't facilitated. And as a consequence of Truffaut calling for the personalization of film, you have generations of filmmakers, like you mentioned, Agnès Varda, phenomenal director. Probably her most famous film is Cleo from 5 to 7. You also have Jane Campion, who made The Piano, Sophie Coppola, who made Lost in Translation, Ava DuVernay, who made the wonderful film Selma, and the phenomenal documentary 13th. These are very, very important film directors who infused great passion and meaning into their work because it's highly personalized.
Well, you've mentioned the personalized aspect of the work a few times too. Us now, and that was there from it's the very beginning, first film, wasn't it? 400 Blows, where he goes to his own life really to tell us the story here, and it was a difficult childhood,
very difficult. Yeah, his mother wasn't married, she was pregnant, she was 17, and the father wanted to have nothing to do with the young boy, so she married a man who gave Truffaut his name. But once François was born, his new parents didn't want him in their life at all. So he went to live with his grandmother until he was about 8 years old. Then she died. And when he came back to the family, he was already very, very alienated from his parents. And so he started mitching off from school. When he was in school, he was getting into huge trouble. He was telling phenomenal lies about his father being arrested by the occupying German army in France in World War II. And then he started getting into thieving. He was stealing things. And his adopted father then caught him stealing some from the office. And he turned him over to the police. And so when young François was eventually released, then he starts running away from home. And so when he is at home and sent to school, he starts mitching from school again. And what he does is he finds a new home in cinema, and he creates for himself a surrogate family with the people he's seeing on screen. And when I say he becomes obsessed with cinema, it's hard to underestimate that. He was going to the films 3 to 4 times a week, and he was going to see a film that he would admire. He'd go to see it again and again and again. So he would actually become so familiar with the film that he wasn't looking at the story. He was looking at the way it was constructed and the shots and the editing patterns. And as a consequence of that, he becomes this walking encyclopedia of film, incredibly knowledgeable, to the point that he inadvertently and unintentionally intimidated his colleagues with the level of knowledge that he had in film. You know, he went on to actually appear as an actor in his own films a few times, and then he appeared in a supporting role in Steven Spielberg's movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And while he was making the film with Spielberg, he made sure that he never took... Well,
can I just hold off on Spielberg for a moment?
Sorry, yes.
I just want to stick with 400 Blows. I'll come to Spielberg because it is a very important aspect, but I don't want to go past 400 Blows. And the way he told that story, from the very outset then, do we see a style that you go, yeah, there it is, right from day one, that's Truffaut?
Absolutely. He loved the long take. And there's a wonderful scene where the young boy Antoine actually finally, towards the end of the film, he runs away from the reform school that he's been sent to. And it's about a 90-second shot where Antoine just runs along a country road. And the shot is so long that, you know, whenever I'm watching it, I find myself breathing at the same rhythm that Antoine is breathing in. And that take, and then, and finally, at the end of the movie, he ends off with this remarkable freeze frame of Antoine when he runs all the way to the sea, where the boy can no longer run. He's run as far as the world will be able to take him. And then he turns and he looks back into the camera, which is a very, very unusual thing to do for an actor, to break the fourth wall. But then what Truffaut did was he froze the frame. He went for a freeze frame. And he's creating Antoine as an icon. It's almost like a painting. Now we're looking at this boy, he's looking at us, and the question we ask ourselves, what's going to become of him? Where is this young boy going to go? And of course the answer is there. He becomes François Truffaut.
Yeah.
You know?
Let's have a listen to Wes Anderson then, speaking about that film, 400 Blows.
Like so many things, I discovered Truffaut in the little video rental section at the back of a record store in Houston when I was 16 or something like that. This movie in particular, I think, was one of the reasons I started thinking I would like to try to make movies. I think it's one of those, it's a sort of Citizen Kane kind of movie where, you know, people say this about the Velvet Underground, that, you know, everybody who listened to this music started a band.
There you go. Wes Anderson speaking about the effect of watching Truffaut's 400 Blows. And Stephen Benedict is with us this evening, speaking about the work of Truffaut. Interesting that Truffaut himself mentioned the idea in the clip we heard of him earlier, Stephen, this idea that, oh, you may do this type of thing in New York where you go to houses to make people's films rather than into the studio like you would do in LA. And it really was, it was New York filmmakers and the big New York filmmakers really that took on many of the Truffaut ideas, wasn't it?
Yeah, and you know, we mentioned Scorsese already, and Scorsese would be a perfect proponent of what Truffaut was on about, because although Scorsese is making movies sponsored by and funded by the studios, he's demanding that he makes them in a very, very idiosyncratic and personal way. And we mentioned the freeze frame there at the end of the 400 Blows, and the freeze frame is something, you know, Truffaut, I stress this, did not invent the freeze frame. But Truffaut used it in such a unique way that it was almost as if he invented it himself. And if you look at films like Goodfellas or The King of Comedy or Raging Bull or The Wolf of Wall Street, Scorsese repeatedly uses the freeze frame.
Yeah.
And he does it for a particular effect. It's to freeze the moment at the most frenetic, kinetic moment of energy. And by freezing it, he actually multiplies the energy again.
Yeah.
You know? But it is interesting that it's the New York filmmakers who take it on, because what Truffaut was talking about, he was looking, by saying, I go to a house, he's actually personalising it as opposed to going to the huge studio, which is what he was railing against in the 50s as a young man and as a critic.
You mentioned, however, Spielberg and Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Having Truffaut on set, that must have been hugely intimidating, surely.
Well, yeah, it would have been, because Spielberg himself, I think, was about 29 or 30, you know, and we've got to remind ourselves that he broke onto the scene as an incredibly young talent as well. But the wonderful thing that Truffaut gave to Spielberg, he didn't give him any, you know, he was respectful enough never to tell Spielberg how to make the movie. But in watching Spielberg make the film, he noticed how brilliantly he was directing this young boy, Cary Guffey, who plays in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And at dinner one evening, he said to Spielberg, you know, you ought to make a movie fully about childhood.
Wow.
And Spielberg took that in mind. And then the result was E.T.
That's interesting, isn't it? Let's listen to Spielberg talking about what it was like then having Truffaut on the set of Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Truffaut is wonderful to work with. He's really amazing. He's a fantastic guy. He really is. He loves movies more than anybody I've ever met in my life. You can take all this new Hollywood bullshit and get all of us guys sitting in a room together, and he puts us away. He knows more about movies than any of us ever will.
Did he try to be influential in any way in terms of how you handled
scenes? No, he didn't. He made suggestions occasionally, and I wanted him to make more, but he would just make them when he felt comfortable about making them.
What a great way to direct somebody. Just make the odd comment here and there. Don't overload it.
Yeah.
Extraordinary stuff from Steven Spielberg there about François Truffaut. Let's move on to one of his other... let me move on to Jules and Jim.
Yeah.
Tell us about this film. First of all, what was the idea behind it and where are we at in Truffaut's development then?
Well, this movie comes out in 62, which is really 3 years into Truffaut's career as a film director. It was his third film. And the great thing about Truffaut was he was very interested in exploring different and making films in different genres. So having made the movie about childhood, he decides I'm not going to repeat myself, because he'd be categorizing himself and confining himself in his talent. So then he goes off and makes a quasi gangster picture in the next picture, a little bit of a musical, a little bit of a comedy. He mixes the genres there. But in Jules et Jim in 62, he took a really, really romantic story on the surface, which appears to be a romantic story, a sort of a menage a trois between two men. men, Jules and Jim, who were in love with this same woman, Catherine, played by Jeanne Moreau. And Jeanne Moreau plays this incredibly elusive, enigmatic, dynamic, volcanic personality, and it completely beguiles the two young guys in the film. And they are friends before they meet her. They're friends before the World War II, World War I begins, and then the film charts the relationship between the three. There's a wonderful moment, we're talking about freeze frames before, there's a wonderful moment where there's a scene that takes place on a veranda. The two young men are playing, it looks like dominoes or something like that to me. And then Catherine asks for their attention and they refuse to give it. And then she starts to pout and simper and laugh and glare at them. And each emotional state she goes through, Truffaut then goes for a freeze frame, as though he's presenting a profile of this person. And so he's showing the woman in a myriad of different ways to avoid the cliché. And this is one of the things that we've got to understand about Truffaut. He personalised his storytelling to a great degree, but he also went for the humanity of it. He went for the humanity in every single story that he could. He tried to avoid the cliché, subvert the cliché, and focus on the individuality of each personality. So that's why Catherine is a really, really remarkably enigmatic, puzzling character. As I said to you, volcanic and enigmatic. So you've no idea what she's going to do in the story.
Right.
And it's one of the reasons why I think it's Truffaut's one of his two greatest films.
Well, let's listen to what Martin Scorsese has to say about it.
This is the beginning of Jules and Jim, the first 3 or 4 minutes, which influenced the style of Goodfellas and Casino and Wolf of Wall Street and so many. But here you see, I think a lot of it has to do with the relentlessness of the voiceover and the rapid speech and also the pace of the music under it. It's pushing the images forward, pushing all of this storytelling forward. It feels like it's a sense of freedom. Anything can happen any moment. You weren't tied to a direct story. This is, the narrative is completely fractured, I think.
Scorsese on Jules and Jim, Truffaut, and mention of the voiceover there. Oh, are we talking about Goodfellas yet again? I suppose we are, Stephen Benedict. Listen, if you had to choose them, you've said that Jules and Jim, you would say, is the best of the Moreau, really, at the height of his powers. You say 400 blows first, Jules and Jim first, or where would you suggest?
It's a toss-up. You know, I've been asked by students sometimes, what's my favourite movie? And I always answer, it depends what mood I'm in. So it would depend what mood I'm in to watch. But the 400 Blows, there's Jules et Jim. He made a really, really great thriller in the 1980s called The Last Metro, which is about the occupation of Paris in World War II. He made a lovely tribute to the cinema in 1973 called With Day for Night. He made a wonderful meditation on death in a film called The Green Room. And then he returned later to examining childhood. It's called The Wild Child. It's about a boy who grew up in a forest without any contact, human contact. And it's about, Truffaut actually plays the doctor who tries to educate the child to speak. So he investigated many, many different things in his films, but right. They were all incredibly personal to his life.
Now you see, I want to see all of them. Thanks, Stephen. That's Stephen Benedict speaking to us this evening about the work of François Truffaut.